Thank you here tonight. It is my honor to introduce our speaker for this weekend. I first was introduced to Harlan by listening to the phone meeting on Sunday mornings. The Vision for You has special podcast, and I got to hear the masterful way in which Harlan presents the 12 steps from the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And then I had the double pleasure of meeting him in person last year at the OA birthday party in LA, and we've kind of become outreach buddies since then, so I consider him a friend of mine. Harlan was born and raised in Chicago and currently lives in Scottsdale, Arizona. He'll frequently call it sweltering Scottsdale, Arizona. Not quite so sweltering now, but still hot compared to where we are. Harlan's been around the rooms of OA since 1979. He's celebrating 19 and a half years of back-to-back abstinence in OA. Harlan, as I said, is an amazing Big Book historian. He can present the history of that Big Book better than anybody I've ever heard, and I love to listen to him. Harlan considers that OA is the most important thing in his life today, and I ditto that. So it is my pleasure at this time to introduce Harlan G.
Had my knee replaced June 5th, is not to tackle those steps. So if I can stay down here, can everybody see me if I sit down? Okay. You can't see me now? Go in the middle. Okay, we'll go in the middle. I just need to bring two benches because I need one for my book. One. Miracles. I look out and this is wonderful. And I'm Harlan G., as Nancy told you, and I am a recovered compulsive overeater. And I thank you. And this is the greatest way of life imaginable for me, but it didn't start out that way for sure. It started out more of a nightmare. And by the time I was a toddler, by the time I was 3 and 4 years old, my weight and the amount of food that I was consuming became the topic of conversation no matter where I went, no matter what was going on. My weight, my food were a constant source of shame to my parents. My mother was about 275 pounds. She was a compulsive overeater. My mother had severe mental illness. My mother had three distinct personalities. My mother could be a three-year-old, and she could stay in that personality for 20 minutes or an hour. She could breathe in air and become a screaming, raving lunatic, or she could breathe in more air, and all of a sudden she'd be a together person. You never knew what you were going to get or for how long. Does that have a bearing on me being a compulsive overeater? No, it does not. And we're going to learn this morning that it has absolutely nothing to do with it. This is not a product of your environment. We're going to learn that it is an allergy of the body and a twist of the mind that we are either born with or we are not born with. We either have it or we don't. And by the time I was 3 years old, I was climbing step stools to get to Chips Ahoy cookies. By the time I was 3 years old, I'd be going nuts when I would go with my dad, and when we would check out, like at a restaurant, I wanted the candy, I wanted the cookies, I wanted the cakes. And if you remember those little mints and the little chocolate ice cubes and stuff like that, that would just get me absolutely bonkers. And I remember, I have very distinct memories. Now, my father was also a compulsive overeater, and he was 54 years old on the day that I was born. And he was not one generation in front of me, he was two. My father came out of Europe prior to World War II, when anti-Semitism in Europe was unbelievable. And he was one of 40 people in a very extended family, and all but him were obliterated off the face of the earth through hatred, of Jews at that time, and he was the sole survivor. He came here from Russia in 1914, didn't at the age of 14. If you look at the at a 14-year-old, ask yourself a question: is this 14-year-old capable of going to a country where they don't speak one word of the language and starting at a completely new life for themselves, and everything and everyone they've ever known is dead or gone? Just ask yourself that, and that's what he had to do. He spoke very little English. He spoke mostly Yiddish. And some of you are going to learn more Yiddish this weekend than you had originally planned as well. And one of the activities that me and my dad could do together was eat and watch television, or eat and throw stuff out the window like litter. You know, we would eat like pistachio nuts, and we would be driving down the street throwing the shells out the window. And by the time I was 5, 6, 7, 8 years old, it was getting worse and worse and worse and worse. And by the time I was 9 years old, I had tried dieting on my own. I had tried everything I could do to throw something in front of the juggernaut of this illness, because there were two things that I knew better than I knew anything else. Number one, I was bad because I was fat. And I was fat because I ate too much food, but I didn't know how not to eat that food. I didn't know what to do. I exerted whatever little willpower I had. I did everything I could. I might as well have shouldered this building and tried to move it to the Palouse, where Oregon is going to play Washington State tomorrow. I'm a duck, so no comments about Oregon. I lived in Eugene, Oregon for 9 years, so I am a duck, and we'll see what happens tomorrow. May the best team win, as long as they wear green uniforms. Okay. Okay. When I was 9 years old, I got put on diet pills by the doctor. I remember going to the doctor. It was a Saturday afternoon. My mother screamed in Yiddish at the doctor. The doctor screamed in Yiddish back at my mother, and they were screaming at each other. And I walked out of that doctor's office with a pill that was supposed to cure and fix everything in my life. And I was put on heavy-duty amphetamines at 9 years. 63, Kennedy killed? Yes, 63. Okay. So 63, Kennedy killed? 9? Yeah, okay. I'm just trying to get it right. Okay. So I'm on heavy-duty amphetamines. Some of the younger people are going, Kennedy got killed? I thought he... Yeah. But anyway... I have memories, vivid ones, of those pills and their effects. I have memories of the temples of my head going ba-boom, 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 ba-boom. And I also have a memory of, I am not a fighter, I am an eater. You know, do whatever you want, just leave my M&Ms with peanuts alone. And by the way, who buys those M&Ms without the peanuts? These are obviously not Jewish people that are buying these M&Ms. Why would you buy M&Ms with no peanuts when you could buy them with the... These are obviously people I don't understand. Okay, now, all right. So, I'm getting into fist fights at school, and I cannot understand why, but I'm saying, and I get accused of this now, but I'm saying the same thing 400 times, and I can't stop myself. And I'm in my head going, but you've already said that 399 times. Stop saying it. And I can't. I'm like a motor mouth. And I can't hear what the teachers are saying. It was like Charlie Brown's teacher. Wah, 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 wah. And my grades are plummeting. I mean, I'm going from a decent student to a student that's just barely getting... I mean, I'm like scraping the bottom of the barrel with grades. And I just... But when those pills wore off, oh, you eat Illinois and most of Wisconsin. Holy mackerel. Man, do you eat. When those pills wear off, it's like jumping off a mountain, and that's the only way I can describe it. And then you get your next dose, and the urge to eat is just not there. But the buildup of emotions is, and the nervousness is there, and the frustration and the anger is there, because I'm an untreated addict. And then when I was 10 years old, 64, I was born in 54, so you don't have to do the math. In 64, some of the information on the effect of these amphetamines started to come back to the doctors. And we had a couple of people out in Hollywood die from these amphetamines. And we had a couple of people that were very famous who had other complications from them. And so they switched me from a pink pill that I took three times a day to a blue pill that I took four times a day with exactly the same effect. I lost a lot of weight, but I also lost a lot of my marbles and my sanity. And those amphetamines were nasty, nasty things, especially when you consider I was 9 and 10 years old. It is a miracle to this day that I'm not popping speed like around the clock. It's really a miracle of God that I'm not doing that. And I tried lose weight with AIDS. Remember those candies? Right? Remember those? And if one of those blasted things would cut your appetite, half a box or a whole box would probably be better. I could do a colonoscopy the next day after you got through with those because, man, do those send you reeling to the bathroom? Holy moly. Oh my God. You could do a colonoscopy, no problem. No problem. And I did, later on when I was a teenager, I was an international Weight Watcher king. I was an international Tops king. Take off pounds sensibly. Do they have Tops out here in this part of the... They do. Oh, you live and learn, I guess. You live and learn, okay. Live and learn. Okay, so I did those. I would lose the weight, and I would very, very quickly put it back on. And puberty was hard. It still is. I'm waiting for it to get easier, but it's not. But puberty was very hard. I was emasculated physically and emotionally by an illness that I did not understand nor that I asked for. And so all I really wanted to do when I was a teenager was die. I knew that I could not live in this world. I knew that there was no point to my existence. I knew that the sad fact of my existence is that I was a fat slob. I didn't understand what was wrong with me. What modicum of willpower were my friends blessed with that I didn't have? And I looked at them, and they could eat three French fries and have a conversation over French fries, and they're sitting on the plate, and I just want to take my fork and go, boop, oh, that's one eye out. Let's see if I can get the other one out. And they're just having these conversations over food, and that is something that I could not do. I could not understand why my friends were so benign emotionally and physically to food that drove me crazy. I have vivid memories of having crushes on girls. I have vivid memories of these things. And of course, I was 335 pounds by the time I was a senior in high school. And I remember when I was a junior in high school, I broke my ankle at gym class. I broke my ankle. And my mother had to traipse over to the high school and get me and take me to the doctor and get my ankle taped up and casted and that. And I remember Dr. Bernstein yelling at my mother, in Yiddish also, and he had these glasses that he wore at the bottom of his nose, like this. And he looked up at my mother and he said, you know, Virginia, he isn't going to live to see 30. He says, I just got this. He says, the weight is over 300 pounds. And it was May of my junior year of high school. By the time senior year came, I was 335. By the time sophomore year of college came, I was over 500. By the time I graduated college, I was over 600. And life was just getting away from me, and the jealousy and the loneliness were closing in on me and checkmating me and not allowing me any type of emotional freedom at all whatsoever. My friends were going to out-of-state schools, and they were having the lives that you see on television, and I was dealing with things at that age that were very, very hard for me to deal with besides my active addiction. My mother was a very sick woman mentally, which I've told you, but she was also very sick physically. My mother went on dialysis when 1976, I was a junior in college. She became very, very gravely ill. And now I don't have brothers and sisters, aunts, uncles, cousins, grandparents. I don't have any of that. It was me, my mom, and my dad, and that was all I had. And so I'm traipsing her back and forth to dialysis. And if you live in Chicago and you have to go to dialysis in December, January, February, March, April, it doesn't matter that there's snow up to your shoulders. You have to get to dialysis. It doesn't matter that the police are urging you not to go on the road. They're urging you to stay home if you possibly can. You've got to get this sick, crazy woman to dialysis. And around the time I was about 17 years old. It was 7 years before it happened. I took my father to the oncologist. Now, my father was a chain smoker. He would smoke Chesterfields one after the other, after the other, after the other. And you couldn't tell Max Grabowski to do anything. The idea of you telling him what to do was so abhorrent to him because life had dictated to him so much at such an early age that his ability to follow any type of thing like that was he was bereft of that. And I went to the doctor with him, and they said he has cancer. And now my mother is dying. My father has cancer, and I'm 17 years old. I don't have brothers and sisters. I don't have aunts, uncles, cousins. I got nothing, right? So I said to the doctor, well, what are you going to do about my dad's cancer? And he got mad at me. He says, where would you like me to start? He says, Dad has esophageal cancer, lung cancer. He has some cancer in the stomach, and he has some cancer that's gone around the corner into the kidneys. Where would you like me to start? And I said, well, how long does he have to live? And he says, I would say you've got a good 6-7 years. My dad died about 7 years to the day of that diagnosis. To the day of that diagnosis. My mother died when I was 22 years of age, and she was finally free of the mental illness that had just ransacked her life. And my dad died when I was 24 years old, and my father was a victim of the most pure hatred you ever saw in your life. My father had a very different take on life than most people do. My father would have his garden in the back of where we lived, and he would stand up, and he always wore a hat, and he always had a cigarette in his mouth. And I was a vendor at Wrigley Field in Sox Park, and he'd laugh when he'd see me come home because the Cubs played only day games in those days. They didn't play night games there yet. And I'd come home, and he'd say, how many Mishigoyim today? And Mishigoyim means crazy people. And I'd say, 37,000, ta. And he'd laugh, and he'd say, what a country. It would be a Tuesday afternoon, and he'd say, 37,000 people with nothing to do but go to a ball game. He'd say, he'd clap his hands, he'd say, what a country. And he would see squirrels or rabbits, or he would see pigeons, and he would say, don't ever forget my son. My son means my son. He says, don't ever forget what a beautiful country you live in. And I'd say, why? He'd say, you see those pigeons? When I was on the run, I would eat those pigeons. He'd say, because if this was a poor country, you wouldn't see pigeons, you wouldn't see squirrels, you wouldn't see rabbits. Somebody would be eating them. And I remember taking him for a ride. I would just put him in the car and take him, and I would take him up to Wisconsin. And he would see the sign on the road. It would say, you are leaving Illinois, the land of Lincoln. And then in about 15, 20 minutes, it would say, welcome to Wisconsin, America's dairy land. And he'd clap his hands together, and he'd say, what a country. What a country. You can go from Illinois to Wisconsin and there's no guards there. You don't need papers. You don't need a reason. You don't have a checkpoint. You can just go. And when I would come back and it would say, you are leaving Wisconsin, and then it would say, welcome to Illinois, the land of Lincoln, he'd clap his hands together and he would say, what a country. What a country. And then when I turned 18, they changed the law so I could vote. And he couldn't say vote. He'd say vote. And I would get so mad at him. I'd say, it's vote, God damn it. He'd say vote. And when I went to vote in the election, Illinois, we didn't have a vote by mail. I love Arizona. One of the reasons I love Arizona is you can vote by mail. I don't have to stand in line at the polling place. What a pleasure. You vote in your own home. But anyway, I was in the polling place and my father passed out. And the fireman was there and the policeman was there. He passed out because he couldn't believe such a thing, that his child was voting and that one person takes office, one person leaves office, there's not a shot fired and no one died. He could not get over such a thing. He couldn't understand, but he was absolutely certain that when Ruby killed Oswald, that they were going to put us in concentration camps again, that they were going to round us up and kill us. He was absolutely sure of it. And he was sure that if something would happen in the news about a Jewish person committing a crime, he'd say, that's it, they're going to kill us out now. They're going to kill us out now. And every day of my life, he would say to me, they hate you, they hate you, they hate you, and they're going to come and kill you one day. He said, when they came to kill me, I wasn't home. He says, one day they'll kill you. He says, if they don't kill you, they'll kill your children. He said, that's just what happens. Because to him, that was reality. To him, that was his reality. That the hatred of mankind, that the hatred of human beings, and for what reason? And for what reason? He couldn't figure it out. And when he finally died, I'm getting verklempt. When he finally died, one of my very, very dear friends turned around on the cemetery as we were walking back to the car, and she said, Mr. G, all the kids in the neighborhood called him Mr. G, and they'd say, Mr. G is free. They'll never hurt him now. There's nothing they can do to him. He's gone, and he's free. And he outlived his murderers. He outlived his murderers. And so he was free. He was freed in that moment. Why am I talking about this? All right, let's get back to recovery now that we've done the political hour here. Okay. So I'm 24 years old and I'm alone. And now my weight is escalating and my food addiction, my food habit in the 1970s, not my cocaine habit, not my heroin habit, not my whatever habit. My food habit in the 1970s is about $100 to $150 a day. I'm writing bad checks to anyone that will cash them. I'm robbing Peter while I'm robbing Paul. I'm lying when the truth would have served me better. I'm living the life of an addict in his addiction, and there is no stopping me at this point. And you can believe anything you want to believe about God. Whether you believe God to be a religious deity or don't, I don't care. Whether you believe God exists or you don't is your business. I know what I believe. And the only thing that's required of any of us is a willingness to believe. A willingness to believe. And tomorrow, if I have time, I'm going to get into the history of step two. I'm going to talk about how step two came into the program. We're going to learn a little bit about that. But I believe that my father had great sway with the Lord, because the last conversation I had with my father, he begged me to find a way to stop eating. He begged me to find a way not to be a slave to food. And he died in November of 78. And on February the 2nd, 1979, just weeks after Dad died, two wonderful friends pushed their way past the filth of my apartment, past the mice, past the pizza boxes, the Oreo cookie bags, past the bakery boxes and the Dorito bags, past the wrappers of whatever candy I might have been eating at that time, and I owed my friends a lot of money. And they said that the jig was up. I'm going to Overeaters Anonymous tonight. And I did not want to go. And I still thought I could control the situation. I still thought I had whatever it took to control this. I just like food. I just want to die. And on February the 2nd, 1979, just weeks after my dad died, the Lord showed me how to get to an OA meeting in Skokie, Illinois, at the Orchard Mental Health Center. The meeting started at 7:30, and I looked around. I was 24 years old at that time. I was 30 years younger than anybody else in that room, and hundreds of pounds fatter than any of them. I could have put any four of them in my pocket. And I knew that I had a problem, but I could not understand what the hell you were doing here. Because it did not seem to me that I would be here if I drove a Cadillac. I wouldn't be here if I had a watch like yours, or money, or a thinner body. Some of you, I looked around that night, and I look around tonight, and I see a lot of the same thing. I wondered to myself then, what the heck are you doing here? And I came in, and I stayed for a while. Funny thing, I didn't really stop eating my first trip through OA, but I did stop smoking. Isn't that funny? You don't come in here. I stopped smoking, stopped almost on a dime. And for years, I would eat my way to the meetings. I would pray for a Russian airstrike during the meetings, and I would eat my way home. And I saw the gurus. I saw Bill Bluestein. We were just talking about this at dinner. I went to a Bill Bluestein retreat. Some of you are around a long time, you remember Bill. And I also met Fred Schneider, that started the HOW program. And he was the guru from the East, from New York. And Bill Bluestein was the guru from the West, and he was from Los Angeles. And I met both of them. And then eventually I met Roseanne. And eventually, you know, when you're in Chicago, if you just wait long enough, they'll all come to you. They'll all come. It's sort of like Scottsdale, Arizona. You sit at the coffee plantation in Scottsdale, and eventually 99% of Chicago is going to walk past you. Eventually they're going to come and they're going to visit, because the Cubs play their spring games there, and you know, they come for the weather. We also come to Arizona because we want to get away from the New Yorkers. So let them go to Florida and we go to Arizona. So now I'm losing my train of thought. I'm just too much into the narishkeit tonight. Narishkeit is a Yiddish word for foolishness. I'm into the narishkeit tonight. I better stick to subject. And I left OA for a while, and I had a beautiful graduation ceremony. Welcome to McDonald's. Can I take your order, please? Same graduation ceremony most of you have had. Because you know what? I don't see a lot of people that come and stay. I don't see that person in OA. I see people that come and go and come and go. And then eventually, if enough buildings fall on your head, eventually you'll stay and you'll get it. And I came back, and I left, and I came back. Only this time, you sons of bees, you put some things in my big book that I never saw before. You came into my house and you put some things in this book that I never saw before. And one of the things that you put in my book that I never saw really before is on page 58 of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's what I like to call step zero. And it says very, very simply, if you want what we have, now what is it we have? See, a lot of people even here don't know what we have. I see a cougar sweatshirt. Okay, now. Go Ducks. Okay, now, I'm sorry. Sorry, I'll be good. I'll be good for the rest of the time. Okay. All right. If you want what we have, what do we have? What do we have? We have people that are not compulsively overeating. There's a lot of people tonight at restaurants and bars and whatever, and Dunkin' Donuts. They're not compulsively overeating either. If you want what we have. Now, what we have are people that are afflicted with a fatal illness that is permanent, progressive, and fatal, that are not eating compulsively, and they are doing so happily. that they are happy in their release because of a spiritual awakening as the result of the steps. That's what we have. The miracle is in the room. You know, I'm going to go to the OA birthday in Los Angeles, and I hope you will too, especially some of you that I know. You better get your butt there. So even if I don't know you, get your butt there. It's a great convention. It's in Los Angeles on the 18th, 19th, and 20th of January. And I am the vice chair this year. And we have got, I don't want to get too sidetracked, we have got some really good stuff coming up this year. We're going to probably have 1,000 people this year. And we're going to have a big book study. And we're going to have panels on every step. And we're going to have a sober eating workshop. We're going to have a sex and body image workshop. We're going to have a workshop on finding a higher power. We're going to have two, count them, two meet and greets for Vision for You people, where you're going to be able to put faces to the voices that you hear on the phone every day. We're going to have sponsor meet and greets. We're going to have a founder's room with a loop of Roseanne S. being interviewed on the history of OA. Some of you never met Roseanne because she's been dead now for a while. So some of you may be curious, what did she look like? What did she sound like? I went to the same grammar school as her, but she was way older than me. But we went to the same grammar school in Chicago. That's, I bet I'm the only one in the room that went to Clinton Grammar School in Chicago. Clinton? Okay. All right. But she was cool, and you can see that. So get your butt to that OA birthday. Just Google OA birthday registration 2019, and it will come right up, and you can register, and I hope to see you there. Okay, getting back to the subject now that we've had a word from our sponsor. Okay. Okay. If you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, are you? Because if you've heard me speak before, or you've never heard me speak before, this is my mantra. This is not a program for people who need it. This is not a program for people who want it. This is a program for people who do it. This is an action program. Recovery is a verb. If you want what we have and you're willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. Now, I also saw something on page 77, which is very essential to my life. It is pure Oxford Group. What is the Oxford Group? You got to come back tomorrow so I can explain it to you. If I have enough time, I'm going to do Bill's story. So you'll see the history of that, and you'll see the history of step two. Pure Oxford Group, page 77, it says, my real purpose is to fit myself to be of maximum service to God and the people about me. Now, one of the prerequisites for me to be of maximum service to anybody is to not be in the food, to be abstinent from my binge foods, to be in recovery. The thesis line of the big book is on page 45. The thesis line of the big book is on page 45, in the middle of the page, and it simply says, the main object of this book is to help you find a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problem. Now, that's what this is going to be all about, Charlie Brown. We're going to have to look at that line in the big book, and if it's the main purpose of the book, it is going to be the main purpose of my life. I also saw something in there in the foreword to the second edition on page XX. It said simply that of 100 people that came into AA, 50% got sober at once. And of the 50 that remained, 25 came back and got sober. That's 75% recovery, and the other 25 showed improvement. That's 75% recovery. We can't talk about 75% recovery today. We can't talk about 10% recovery today. We can't talk about 5% recovery today. We are lucky if we can talk about 1.5, 2% recovery today. In Albuquerque, I have been a delegate for the Phoenix Intergroup over the last several years. It's been my honor and pleasure to serve the Arizona Serenity and the Desert Intergroup as a delegate over the last 2 years. What do you hear every year? Declining membership, declining finances. Why? Because people are not, they're getting away from this. We're getting away from a pure message. OA doesn't have a financial problem. We have a recovery problem. If more people came in and recovered, this place would be way too small to have this. Because this is the epidemic that we're facing today. This dwarfs alcoholism and drug addiction and everything else. Did you know that in 1995 in the United States of America, not the United States of Outer Mongolia, not the United States of whatever, we had a generation of Americans born that have a shorter lifespan than their parents? What is the number one assignable reason? Childhood obesity, type 2 diabetes. You have 7, 8, and 9-year-olds today with type 2 diabetes in numbers that in the 1950s and 60s were absolutely unheard of. Now, we may never get to 75%, but I'll be damned if we can't do better. And it's got to start with me. It's got to start with me. I can't look externally and say, here's what you need to do, here's what you need to do, here's what... No, no. It's got to start with me. If it's going to be, it starts with me. I'm going to encapsulate my story and get to the doctor's opinion because I want to cover the doctor's opinion tonight. But I just want to say that I've lost a little over 500 pounds since the beginning. I was over 700 pounds. I have 19 and a half years of abstinence. If I had a pill up here that could give you recovery, I would smash it with my foot and throw it in the toilet. This is the greatest way of life on earth. It is a life of service. It is a life of rewards. It is a beautiful, beautiful life. And out of the filth and manure that brought us here, out of the nightmare, the hell that washed us ashore here in OA, will come something beautiful. That you have the power, you have that qualification to touch another human life as no one else can. Bill Wilson, at the end of his life, said, "To those who understand, no explanation is necessary. To those who don't, none is plausible." You have the language of the heart that you speak and understand as no one can. I was sitting at dinner tonight, and there were people there, one I know, one I met before, and the others I not so much. But we could speak and we could understand, and there is a glue that holds our souls together. Don't quit 5 minutes before the miracle. Don't stop. Don't stop. Is your recovery going in the direction you want it to go? If not, change something. Is it going in the direction? Is it doing fine? Pass it on. Pass it on. And in so doing, you will open up a world to yourself. You will open up a world that you never dreamed possible. The fattest kid on the north side, the fattest kid in the school, the kid that people would make fun of me, children would laugh at me, strangers would slap my stomach, people that I didn't even know would come up to me in restaurants and take food off my plates, and they would give it to the busboy and say, "He's too fat, he doesn't need this." The kid that had an 80-inch pair of pants that his friend, the dry cleaner, had to put a slat of material in on the backside so I could wear size 80-inch pants. The kid who couldn't go to the movies because I couldn't fit in the seat. The kid whose thighs were in different zip codes. the kid who couldn't stop eating, and my tears would go into the food and make it salty. And I wanted to stop more desperately than I wanted to breathe with an elephant on my chest. I wanted to stop more than anything. There was nothing I wanted more than to stop eating like this. But I couldn't stop, and I didn't stop until God took my hand. Until you gave me a book, and you gave me the power to go a day. And I knew that it was going to be years before I was in anything resembling a normal body. I lost 200 pounds in this program, and I was still a 500-pound man. I went on my first date with a girl when I was 35 years old. I never held a girl's hand until I was in the circle of prayer at a meeting, and this lady over here was probably 80 years old, and this lady over here was about 82 years old, and I was 24, and I looked up at God and I said, "It counts. I'm holding their hand. It counts." This, to encapsulate the title of Roseanne's book, this life is beyond our wildest dreams. Don't stop. Don't stop. Pass it to others. Put down the food. All right, let's go to page X. This book has had it. XXV in whatever edition. Go to the doctor's opinion. Let's find out what it is we suffer from. How much time do I have? Forget it. Don't matter. Don't worry. Don't worry about it. It's okay. Okay. Oh, by the way, I didn't finish my thought. That kid that was emasculated physically and emotionally, that fat kid, he's up here as the keynote speaker at your convention. And that's the point I wanted to make and almost forgot. So God can do amazing things. God can do amazing things. Challenge him. See where you can find him lacking. You will not find him lacking. You will not find him lacking. He knows where he needs you. He knows you. He loves you. He adores you. He just wants you to recover. He's not going to come and slap that food out of your hand. So don't call me up and say, "I can't get abstinent." I'm not a believer in can't. I'm a believer in will and won't, but I'm not much of a believer in can't. I do hold great sway with will and won't. For thousands of years, going back to Solomon in Israel in the time of the Old Testament, in the book of Solomon in the Old Testament, Solomon believed that alcoholism, gluttony, which is something we'll talk about Sunday when we talk about A.G. Ainsworth and all that, was an illness. But he couldn't prove it, and he had no cure for it. In England, around the time of the 1640s, there was a doctor who lived in England, and he also celebrated the same holidays as me. And he believed, Dr. Trotter, he believed that alcoholism was an illness, but he couldn't prove it and he had no cure for it. One of the signers of the Declaration of Independence, a man named Dr. Benjamin Rush, he was one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence. In 1790, he wrote a paper in which he believed that alcoholism was an illness, but he couldn't prove it, and he had no cure for it. In the 1920s in New York City, there was a neurologist, unconcerned with alcoholism, unconcerned with gluttony, unconcerned with addiction, and he had a little too much of his money tied up in the stock market. And on October the 29th, 1929, Black Tuesday, he lost about everything he had. And his name was Dr. William Duncan Silkworth. And his very dear friend was Charlie Towns. And Charlie Towns owned and operated what was at that time the preeminent hospital for the treatment of alcoholism, drug addiction in the country, so named the Towns Hospital in New York. And in November of 1929, William Duncan Silkworth went to work as that hospital's medical director for $35 a week. And he observed hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people, mostly men, not all, but mostly men, going in and out of the hospital. And some of these dudes would come into the hospital in horrible shape. And he would medicate them, and he would feed them, and he would take care of their medical needs, and eventually they went home, never to return. But about 10% of these guys, they would go in horrible shape, and he would take care of their medical needs too, and he would build them back up, and he would release them. That day, that month, or that year, they'd be back in horrible, horrible shape. And he started to draw some conclusions about what was going on with these guys. And he started to formulate an opinion of what this was. Let's find out about it. Let's go to page XXV. It says, "We of Alcoholics Anonymous believe that the reader will be interested in the medical estimate of the plan of recovery described in this book. Convincing testimony must surely come from from medical men who have had experience with the sufferings of our members and have witnessed our return to health. A well-known doctor, chief physician, at a nationally prominent hospital specializing in alcoholic and drug addiction, gave Alcoholics Anonymous this letter. To whom it may concern, I have specialized in the treatment of alcoholism for many years. In late 1934, I attended a patient who, though he had been a competent businessman of good earning capacity, was an alcoholic of a type I had come to regard as hopeless." Now, this word hopeless is a good word. Good word. Because I have to be out of ideas. While I'm harboring the I'm going to be abstinent 6 days a week and Sunday I'm going to eat everything I want to eat program, you can't help me. While I have it in my head that I'm going to work this, thank you, my way, you cannot help me. I have to be out of ideas, and probably one of the qualifications I'm going to need to be is hopeless. So this is a very good word. In the course of his third treatment, now we're going to learn in Bill's story that Bill's going to be hospitalized for his alcoholism three times. He acquired certain ideas concerning a possible means of recovery, Oxford Group. As part of his rehabilitation, he commenced to present his conceptions to other alcoholics, impressing upon them that they must do likewise with still others. This has become the basis of a rapidly growing fellowship of these men and their families. This man and over 100 others appear to have recovered. Now, you hear this in Vision for You, and you hear it in OA sometimes. Recovered. Can you recover? Yes, but you'll never be cured. I've had a cold. I recovered from my cold. Does that mean I'll never get another cold? I hope so, but I wouldn't bet on it. I sure as hell wouldn't bet on it because I get colds once or twice a year for 64 years now. I am recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body, but I'm not cured. I personally know scores of cases who were of the type with whom other methods had failed completely. I'm going to assume that if you're in this room, that the methods failed completely with you too. Because if they had succeeded, I doubt whether you'd be here or not. I don't think so. If those diets had worked, you probably wouldn't be here. These facts appear to be of extreme medical importance because of the extraordinary possibilities of rapid growth inherent in this group. They may mark a new epoch in the annals of alcoholism. These men may well have a remedy for thousands of such situations. You may rely absolutely on anything they say about themselves. Very truly yours, William D. Silkworth. Now, I want to point something out to you that you may or may not know. I'm still crecking around here. I walk in the pool now against the resistance of the water. What a miracle that is. I never even heard of such a thing. And they said, well, you're going to hear about it now. So I walk in the pool, and man, it is amazing. You get in the pool, and every time your leg moves forward, you bring it up and force. It's like you're kicking a field goal. You force that leg out, and man, that does its work. But anyway, every single time you walk into a meeting of Overeaters Anonymous, you are walking in here on the shoulders of giants. And one of those giants is William Silkworth. And when this book first came out, and Bill Wilson asked Silkworth to write his opinion, Silkworth said, I will do it, but don't you dare put my name in there. They'll run me out of the medical profession. Because this book was written in 37 and 38 and published in April of 39. The American Medical Association, the American Psychiatric Association, had not accepted alcoholism as an illness, and they would have run Silkworth out of the medical field. In the 10th printing, Harry Thiebaud, the noted psychiatrist of Bill Wilson's, Harry Thiebaud wrote a paper in which the American Psychiatric Association, American Medical Association, accepted alcoholism as an illness, and Silkworth said for the 11th printing in 1950, okay, Bill, you can put my name in there now. So we have his name in there, but for the first 10 printings of this book, you don't. And the reasons that you don't is what I just explained to you, that it would have been dangerous for his career. He risked his neck to save your life. And he's just one of many. And he died in 1951, but he remains to this day our great medical benefactor. He's the little doctor who loved drunks. And his theories are proven every year at Yale University's Alcoholic Studies curriculum. What he said and what he theorized with no scientific backup at all is 100% true. Let's find out what he said, and let's find out what they've proven. The physician who at our request, I'm on XXVI, the physician who at our request gave us this letter has been kind enough to enlarge upon his views in another statement which follows. In this statement, he confirms what we who have suffered alcoholic torture must believe, and the depth at which you will accept Dr. Silkworth's opinion will mark the urgency that you will attack the rest of the steps. Until you accept this, you will do nothing. Until you accept what is in this chapter, you will probably do very little or nothing. Must believe - that the body of the alcoholic is as abnormal as his mind. This is the very first mention of a physical manifestation of this illness. Up until now, it was thought of as weak willpower, stupidity, laziness, an inability to get your life together, you don't care, you don't care about your family, you're a bum and you're a drunk. That there is a physical component to this. It did not satisfy us to be told we could not control our drinking just because we were maladjusted to life, that we were in full flight from reality, or were outright mental defectives. These things were true to some extent, in fact, to a considerable extent with some of us, but we are sure that our bodies were sickened as well. In our belief, any picture of the alcoholic which leaves out this physical factor is incomplete. The doctor's theory that we have an allergy. Make sure that word allergy is highlighted in your book and in your brain. To alcohol interests us as laymen, our opinion as to its soundness may, of course, mean little. But as ex-problem drinkers, we can say his explanation makes good sense. It explains many things for which we cannot otherwise account. Now, what is he talking about there? What he's talking about there is, in my friends, when they eat a hamburger, they do not want a second hamburger. When they eat food, the more food they eat, the less food they want to continue eating. In my body, I want that second hamburger more than I wanted the first one. And I want the third one more than I want the second one, and on and on. In my body, the more I eat, the more I want. The more I want, the more I eat, the more I eat, the more I want, the more I want, the more I eat, and it's just endless. And I went to a meeting in 1979, and somebody said to me, "Don't eat ice cream sandwiches. You're allergic to them." And I'd say, "You're nuts. I'm eating 40, 50 ice cream sandwiches a week. I don't break out in a rash. I don't get itchy, watery eyes. I'm not sneezing or coughing, or I don't have anything like, yeah, my belly is swollen up from blubber, but yeah, other than that, I have no manifestation." And they said, "Just don't eat them." And I went home and I used a very archaic form of knowledge. And if you don't know what this is, you can Google it. It is called a dictionary. Some of you are old enough to remember those. And I went and I looked up the word allergy in this dictionary, and I found several meanings to this word. One of them fit me exactly. It simply said an adverse, abnormal reaction to a food, beverage, or substance. My reaction to the food is adverse means it's harmful. My reaction to the food is abnormal. Only 1 out of 10 people reacts to food the way I do. In a normal person's body, that food will pass through them in such a way that it does not create an actual physical craving for more of the same. But in my body, when I ingest certain foods, I will be absolutely unable to control the amount of those foods that I am now going to eat. I had every intention of eating 1 or 2 Oreos, and before I could say 2 and 2 is 4, the entire package of Oreos was gone. And so was a gallon of ice cream. And so were a big Dorito bag, and so whatever, and on and on and on and on. The more I ate, the more I want, the more I want, the more I ate, and it was just endless. And that is because when those foods are ingested into my body, I will not be able to control the amount I eat because of an actual scientific, physical craving for more of the same. And if I am ingesting those foods today, no matter how long I've been abstinent, they will have the same effect, only worse. The disease is permanent. It is fatal. It is progressive. That means it gets worse over time, never better. Though we work out our solution on the spiritual as well as an altruistic plane, we favor hospitalization for the alcoholic who is jittery or befogged. More often than not, it is imperative that a man's brain be cleared before he is approached, as he then has a better chance of understanding and accepting what we have to offer. What did Silkworth just tell you for the first of 3 times in this chapter? Put down the food. He said, put down the food. And that's what he's telling you. Stop potskiing around. Put it down. You cannot have a spiritual awakening as the result of anything if you're still eating your allergic foods. It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. Not to you. It's not going to happen. You need me to say it a few more times? Okay. Put down the food. It's not going to happen. Okay? He's going to tell you that three times. The doctor writes, "The subject presented in this book seems to be of paramount importance to those afflicted with alcoholic addiction. I say this after many years' experience as medical director of one of the oldest hospitals in the country treating alcoholic and drug addiction. There was, therefore, a sense of real satisfaction when I was asked to contribute a few words on a subject which is covered in such masterly detail in these pages." This paragraph coming up, we're going to cover twice. We doctors have realized for a long time that some form of moral psychology was of urgent importance to alcoholics, but its application presented difficulties beyond our conception. What with our ultra-modern standards, our scientific approach to everything, we are perhaps not well equipped to apply the powers of good that lie outside our synthetic knowledge. What's he telling you there? I'm going to change some of the words, and it's going to amplify the meaning for you, I hope. Remember that Silkworth is a doctor. He's a man of science. He's not a man of religion. He's not in the Oxford group. He's not an alcoholic. That's why this was in the chapter one at the beginning, and then they moved it. They moved it to the Roman numeral section because Silkworth is not an alcoholic, and the book is supposed to be for alcoholics by alcoholics. So they moved this. You hear people say the first 164 pages have never been changed. That's not true. They changed step 12 from spiritual experience to spiritual awakening. And in chapter 3, they changed the number of stories that are in the back of the book. And they moved Silkworth's doctor's opinion. There used to be 12 chapters. Now there's 11 because this was moved. Okay, what's he saying here? I'm going to change some of the words. We doctors have realized for a long time that some form of spiritual awakening was of urgent importance to alcoholics, but its application presented difficulties beyond medicine's conception. What with medicine's ultra-modern standards, medicine's scientific approach to everything, medicine is perhaps not well equipped to apply the powers of God that lie outside our medical knowledge. What's he telling you there? I know what's wrong with you. I'm sure of it, and there's not a damn thing I can do to help you. There's nothing he can do to help you. There's nothing your doctor can do, and we have dumped a truckload of dreck onto the lawn of the medical profession, and we have said to the medical profession, cure us. Cure us, damn it, cure us. And they operate on us. There's people in this room that have had bariatric surgery. There's people in this room that have had various procedures done, and they're still here. And there's people in this room that have been on Fen-Phen. And there's people in this room that have had the urine of pregnant women shot up their butt. And there's, you're laughing, but it's very, there are people sitting right beside you that paid good money to do that. And there are people in this room that have paid somebody to wire their jaws shut. And there are people in this room that have paid money for hypnotists. And they've paid money to psychiatrists. And they've paid money to all manner of people to try to cure them. And Dr. Silkworth is telling you here, I know what's wrong with you. And there's nothing I can do for you. Absolutely nothing. Let's continue. Otherwise, they'll get mad at me for running over. Many years ago, one of the leading contributors to this book came under our care in this hospital, and while here, he acquired some ideas which he put into practical application at once. Later, he requested the privilege of being allowed to tell his story to other patients here, and with some misgiving, we consented. These cases we have followed through have been most interesting. In fact, many of them are amazing. The unselfishness of these men as we have come to know them, the entire absence of profit motive, and their community spirit is indeed inspiring to one who has labored long and wearily in this alcoholic field. They believe in themselves and still more in the power. Note that power is capitalized. He's talking about God, which pulls chronic alcoholics back from the gates of death. Of course, an alcoholic ought to be freed from his physical craving for liquor, and this often requires a definite hospital procedure before psychological measures can be of maximum service. What's he telling you there? Put down the food. We believe, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy. excuse me, that the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. These allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all, and once having formed the habit, found they cannot break it. Once having lost their self-confidence, their reliance upon things human, their problems pile up on them and become astonishingly difficult to solve. Losing self-confidence. How was I not going to lose self-confidence? Everything I tried to live in this world failed. I had crushes on girls. They didn't have crushes on me. I wanted to succeed in business. I couldn't. I was too busy eating and I was too fat. How was I going to walk in for a job at 500-600 pounds? Who was going to hire me? Who was going to hire me at 500 pounds? Who was going to hire me when all I could do was eat and eat and eat and eat? Where was my self-confidence? Are you kidding me? I had none. I was confident I would fail. I was hoping I would die. I was confident I wasn't fit to live in this world. I was confident that I'd live out my life as a freak. But I had no confidence in anything positive, only negative. It's a miracle I didn't take a piece of glass and kill myself. It's a miracle I didn't take a knife and just stick it into my throat. Because, oh, I wanted to so badly. Oh, I wanted to so badly. Just to end the pain. Just to end the pain. I just wanted the pain to go away. Frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices. Frothy means without substance. Screaming at me didn't work. Yelling at me didn't work. Begging me didn't work. Bribing me didn't work. The message which can hold interest and hold these alcoholic people must have depth and weight. Let's stop right there for just a second. Now, we as an organization are spending a lot of money and manpower, women power, to attract new people into the rooms of OA. That's good work. We should do that. I think it's great. I support that work. I think it's wonderful. I myself was on the 12th Step Within Committee at World. Because I believe this too. There are people sitting beside you in the meetings dying of their untreated addiction. And we are hugging them to death. We're hugging them to death. They're sitting right in the room. We have to be more aware of this. Not in a mean way, not in an accusatory way, not in a way that would put anyone off, but in a loving way. Is there anything I can do to help? Is there something I can do to help? We speak the language of the heart, and we understand it. We're the only ones that can help. We're the only ones that know what that's like. Others just don't know. They just simply don't know. And we have to take that knowledge and with love say to somebody, "Can I help?" We're hugging each other to death. And we're dying. We're dying. At too great a rate. Their ideals, in nearly all cases, their ideals must be grounded in a power greater than themselves if they are to recreate their lives. You have to hit a bottom. And that bottom is going to be different for different people. What is the bottom? The bottom is when the fear of letting go of the food is outweighed by the fear of what the food is doing to you and not for you. When that food stops working, you can't get drunk and you can't get sober, then maybe we can reach you. If any feel that a psychiatrist directing a hospital for alcoholics, we appear somewhat sentimental, let them stand with us a while on the firing line, see the tragedies, the despairing wives, the little children. Let the solving of these problems become a part of their daily work and even of their sleeping moments. And the most cynical will not wonder that we have accepted and encouraged this movement. We feel after many years of experience that we have found nothing which has contributed more to the rehabilitation of these men than the altruistic movement now growing up among them. men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. This paragraph is one of the foundation stones of recovery. Make sure you study it throughout your life and pass it to others. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, they cannot, after a time, differentiate the true from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. They are restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks, drinks which they see others taking with impunity after they have succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, and the phenomenon of craving develops. They pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to drink again. This is repeated over and over, and unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there's little hope of his recovery. What is he saying to you here? If you're sleeping, wake up. This is information that can save your life. This is information that is vital to your life. I'm going to say something to you that you do not hear in your OA meetings. You don't see it in literature. And I'm going to let you in on the secret. Food was never the problem. Food for the compulsive overeater is the solution to the problem. The food was the solution to the problem. So if food was the solution to the problem, what is the problem? What is the problem? The problem is the buildup of everyday normal human emotion. Now, all human beings have fear, happiness, jealousy, anger, regret, remorse. All human beings have these emotions. For years, I had German Shepherds. Years. I had Honey Bear, and I had Heidi, and we had Hallis, and we had Emma. And we had German Shepherds for years. German Shepherds have emotions. You have them too. And in a normal person, when these emotions build to a certain level, they can do things to dissipate the toxicity of these emotions, like go drive out a bucket of balls, go take a hike in the woods, go to the gym, make love, play with the dog, play with the cat. You see them every day. They're having a crisis, they're having a situation, they go to the gym, they work it out, they're fine. Or they go out and they have a couple of beers, everything's good. They don't get drunk, everything's groovy, right? You see them all your life. But in us, those emotions will pinball around and around and around and around so that the pain of not eating is too much to bear. And eating becomes a step up from where you are. And the pain of not eating is so horrible. You cannot stand it anymore. And the mental twist says, eat an Oreo cookie. And your consciousness tries to say, no, no, don't do that. And your brain, your mental twist, calls in its ally, the mental blank spot. And the mental blank spot is the built-in forgetter. And you can no longer recall what those Oreo cookies did to you. You can only focus in on what those Oreo cookies will do for you. And you convince yourself that you will just have two of them. And you eat the first one. And you eat the second one. And before long, you've eaten the 80th one. Because what happened is, after you ate the first Oreo cookie, you felt tremendously better because you experienced the effect that comes instantly by eating the food. And that effect is the sense of ease and comfort that comes at once by eating the food. A Milky Way bar will make me feel for about 9 seconds like the world is a very beautiful place. I mean, it is groovy. It is beautiful. Everything is beautiful for about 9 seconds. And then the horror of what I have done, the pall of horror and remorse is upon me. But by then, what have I done by eating an Oreo cookie? I have triggered the physical allergy, and it is impossible for me to stop once I've started. And I have eaten everything in sight. And I will pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to eat this way again. And I will repeat that cycle over and over and over and over again, the mind telling me that that ice cream makes perfect sense while the body ensures that it does not. Now, if I cannot eat Oreo cookies because of the physical allergy, and I can't keep from eating them because of the twist of the mind, I am powerless over food, and my life is unmanageable. Now, when I take a look at the first step, we admitted we were powerless over food and our lives had become unmanageable. What I often suggest to my sponsees is, let's take a look at, we admitted we were powerless over our normal human emotions and our food has become unmanageable. Because as human beings, you will never be devoid of emotion. That's why diets don't work. That is the nature of your powerless condition. That is the nature of what has been driving you into the food from the day you were born. When that switch flipped, that's what's been going on. That is the mechanism of death that this disease has wrought upon the people who suffer from it. It's a twist of the mind that says, this food makes perfect sense. I cannot stand the pain that I'm in. And food becomes a welcome alternative. I eat it in hopes that this time maybe it won't kill me, but I got to get out of the pain that I'm in. And I can't stop because of the allergy. So it begs the question, what if I could find a way to live where my mind does not lock in on that sense of ease and comfort that comes instantly by eating the food? What if I could find a way to live where I already feel better? And the process of bringing a higher power into this equation, the necessary power into this equation, is simply called recovery. And that's what this is all about, Charlie Brown. We are going to substitute the effect of the recovery for the effect of the food. There are two doors in front of me as I wake in the morning. When I am in pain, I can eat an Oreo, and that will work beautifully, but it has death-defying side effects. I can work the steps. They work beautifully too. They require effort, but they have miracles and rewards and no death-defying side effects. No cardiologist has ever said to me, I don't think you should be sponsoring so many people. No cardiologist has ever said to me, I don't think you should be doing as much at Intergroup. No cardiologist has ever said to me, I think you ought to cut back on those damn meetings you go to. That has never happened to me. Never, not once, and it will not happen to you too. So I hope that tonight, and we're going to finish the doctor's opinion, that this gives you a better understanding of what we're talking about in terms of the problem and the solution. I hope that in some way you now better understand the powerless condition of mind and body. Okay, this paragraph that we just covered is essential to recovery like sunlight is to the growth of a forest. Without an understanding of this, and again, I'm going to repeat something. The depth at which you accept Dr. Silkworth's opinion will mark the urgency with which you will work the rest of the steps. Without a knowledge of this, if you are a compulsive overeater and you understand your powerless condition, you must go out and work the rest of the steps, because there is nothing that is of this earth that is going to help you. Money won't do it. Fame won't do it. Poverty won't do it. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what you are or who you are. It doesn't matter whether you're Jew or Gentile, male or female, black or white, Christian, Catholic, Muslim, Buddhist. It doesn't matter. If you have this disease, you have an illness which only a spiritual awakening will conquer. There is no other solution. Let's continue. On the other hand, I'm on XXIX, or 29 in Roman numeral. On the other hand, and strange as this may seem to those who do not understand, once a psychic change has occurred, the very same person who seemed doomed, who had so many problems, he despaired of ever solving them, suddenly finds himself easily able to control his desire for alcohol, the only effort necessary being that required to follow a few simple rules. And what are the rules? The rules are the steps. Men have cried out to me in sincere and despairing appeal, "Doctor, I cannot go on like this. I have everything to live for. I must stop, but I cannot. You must help me." Faced with this problem, if a doctor is honest with himself, he must sometimes feel his own inadequacy. Excuse me. Although he gives all that is in him, it is often not enough. One feels that something more than human power is needed to produce the essential psychic change. Though the aggregate of recoveries resulting from psychiatric effort is considerable, we physicians must admit we have made little impression on the problem as a whole. Many types do not respond to the ordinary psychological approach. I do not hold with those who believe that alcoholism is entirely a problem of mental control, willpower. For I have had many men who had, for example, worked a period of months on some problem or business deal which was to be settled on a certain date favorably to them. They took a drink a day or so prior to the date, and then the phenomenon of craving at once became paramount to all other interests, so that the important appointment was not met. These men were not drinking to escape. They were drinking to overcome a craving beyond their mental control. What forced them into the first drink? The buildup of emotion. What forced him into the 50th drink? The physical allergy. You have a mental twist that drives you into the first bite, and a physical allergy which makes it impossible for you to stop. There are many situations which arrive out of the phenomenon of craving, which cause men to make the supreme sacrifice rather than continue to fight. There are 161 people registered for this convention, and I dare say there isn't one of you that hasn't buried a person and mourned the loss of a person who died from this addiction. The loss is insurmountable. We don't want to lose you. There are men and women at the level of trustees, and men and women at the level of regions and the board and world service, who are doing everything they can to reach out to you. There are people at the meeting level, which is the most important level of service there is at the meeting level. But there are people at the meeting level, all due respect, the most important service is at the meeting level, that are trying to help. Don't die. There's help available. It's a blue book and it's a fellowship. Don't die. We will cry for you when you do. But life will go on. But we'll be sad because we'll miss you. Don't die. You don't have to die. There is recovery. There are people that are working this program that are compulsive overeaters that are not eating compulsively. There are people in this room that will help you. There is a God. It's not, there's two things I need to know about God. There is one and it's not me. There is one and it's not me. It's God as you understand God. There is a God and it works. This program works. One of the most important sentences on page 88 of the Big Book, it says it works, it really does. Work the program. See if you can find where it's lacking. I bet you can't. The classification, I'm on page XXX. The classification of alcoholics seems most difficult and is in much detail is outside the scope of this book. There are, of course, the psychopaths who are emotionally unstable. We are all familiar with this type. They're always going on the wagon for keeps. They are always over remorseful and make many resolutions but never a decision. A decision refers to step three. Step three is a beginning and a decision. There is the type of man who is unwilling to admit he cannot take a drink. He plans various ways of drinking. He changes his brand or his environment. There is the type who always believes that after being entirely free from alcohol for a period of time, he can take a drink without danger. There is the manic depressive type who is perhaps the least understood by his friends and about whom a whole chapter could be written. Then there are the types entirely normal in every respect except in the effect alcohol has upon them. They are often able, intelligent, friendly people. All these and many others have one symptom in common. They cannot start drinking without developing the phenomenon of craving. That's the physical allergy. This phenomenon, as we have suggested, may be the manifestation of an allergy which differentiates these people and sets them apart as a distinct entity. It has never been by any treatment with which we are familiar permanently eradicated. This disease is permanent, it is fatal, and it is progressive. It gets worse over time, never better. The only relief we have to suggest is entire abstinence. And what's he telling you there for the third of three times? Put down the food. This immediately precipitates us into a seething cauldron of debate. Much has been written pro and con, but among physicians, the general opinion seems to be that most chronic alcoholics are doomed. What is the solution? Perhaps I can best answer this by relating one of my experience. About 1 year prior to this experience, this is about Hank Parkhurst. A man was brought in to be treated for chronic alcoholism. He had but partially recovered from a gastric hemorrhage, had seemed to be a case of pathological mental deterioration. He had lost everything worthwhile in life, was only living, one might say, to drink. He frankly admitted and believed that for him there was no hope. Following the elimination of alcohol, there was found to be no permanent brain injury. He accepted the plan outlined in this book. 1 year later, he called to see me, and I experienced a very strange sensation. I knew the man by name and partly recognized his features, but there all resemblance ended. From a trembling, despairing, nervous wreck had emerged a man brimming over with self-confidence and contentment. I talked with him for some time, but was not able to bring myself to feel I had known him before. To me, he was a stranger, and so he left me. A long time has passed with no return to alcohol. Now we have Fitz Mayo here. When I need a mental uplift, I often think of another case brought in by a physician prominent in New York. The patient had made his own diagnosis and, deciding his situation hopeless, had hidden in a deserted barn determined to die. He was rescued by a searching party and in desperate condition brought to me. Following his physical rehabilitation, he had had a talk with me in which he frankly stated he thought the treatment a waste of effort unless I could assure him, which no one ever had, that in the future he would have the willpower to resist the impulse to drink. His alcoholic problem was so complex and his depression so great that we felt his only hope would be through what we then called moral psychology, spiritual awakening, and we doubted if even that would have any effect. However, he did become sold on the ideas contained in this book. He has not had a drink for a great many years. I see him now and then, and he is as fine a specimen of manhood as one could wish to meet. I earnestly advise every alcoholic to read this book through, and though perhaps he came to scoff, he may remain to pray. William D. Silkworth, M.D. Now again, the depth at which you accept this will mark the urgency that you'll work the rest of the steps. Now, You got to play by the rules. These are the rules. No food questions. It's a waste of time for me to sit here and talk to you about my food. I'm a 64-year-old man. You have a different food thing. And no math questions, damn it. No math questions. I'm terrible at math. No math and no food. But other than that, I'll take about five of them. Yes, in the back. Yes. Boredom is an emotion. Boredom, mundane boredom is an emotion. It is the buildup of emotions which is driving you into the food. That's what's doing it. Those emotions are waking up the mental twist, and the mental twist is driving you into the food. You're thinking thoughts about things, or you're thinking about nothing, but those emotions are welling up in you. Nobody? Yes. Uh-huh.
Okay. So,
I have no opinion on Emotions Anonymous. It's an outside issue.
Okay.
I have no opinion on any other program.
So this whole thing with the mental twist, as you put it, is emotions.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. But I have no opinion on any other 12-step program.
So it's emotions. Mm-hmm. With the ability to turn, turn to food.
Mm-hmm.
And to have put away the food.
Okay.
Food.
Okay. I need the question.
I know.
Sorry. You have to put down the food. How do you put down the food? You are powerless, but you are not helpless. And you are going to diet with group support for the first couple of days. You are going to diet until you have a spiritual awakening. You are going to have to force yourself to put the food down. And it's going to be tough. And it's going to be brutal for a while. But that's the only way to put it down is to put it down. It's no more complicated than that. No more complicated. You are going to be dieting for that first little while there. But the faster you work the steps, the faster you have the spiritual awakening, and the urge to eat is just not there. So you put it down by putting it down. Hope that answers it. Anybody else? Going once? Oh, this is either they're tired or something. In the back, all the way in the back. I listen to personal stories all the time. I am a podcast junkie. I learn a lot. I listen to Clancy. I listen to Dr. Bob. I listen to Bill Wilson. I listen to a lot of OA speakers that I have a great deal of respect for. I listen to Clarence Snyder. I listen to a lot of the pioneers of AA. Jimmy Burwell, the resident atheist, I listen to him. I'm not an atheist, but I love listening to Jimmy. I listen to a lot of OA speakers. I think I learn as much by listening to them as I do by any other means or any other methods. So I recommend listening to other people's stories. It's very educational. You know, we hear, I'm going to use a Yiddish word, you hear your mishigas coming out of someone else's mouth, and all of a sudden you don't feel as alone. Mishigas is craziness, which is different from narishkeit, which is foolishness. But when you hear your craziness coming out of someone else's mouth, that makes me feel less alone. So I recommend listening. There are many wonderful, wonderful resources. AVisionForYou.info, Los Angeles, Overeaters Anonymous, you know, if that doesn't get you started, there's just what I just gave you, Los Angeles Overeaters Anonymous, plus a vision for you that would keep you listening till you're 95.
Yes.
Till you're 95. There was another one right over here. Yes. Right.
I often feel like this has happened to me before I'm even aware of it.
Correct.
Tipping point.
Correct.
So what do you suggest?
Work the steps. Work the steps. Work the steps. And when you work, what is the purpose of the steps? The purpose of the steps is to lower the level of these emotions so that they do not build to the toxic red line, forcing you to eat. I know that the purpose of the steps, you get right with God, you get right with yourself, right with your fellow human being. There's lots of differences. But what is ultimately the purpose of the steps is to lower the level of these emotions. The mental twist is activated by that buildup of emotion. The emotion will drive the mental twist. You will eat the food. You'll trigger the allergy. You'll pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to eat that way again. And you will repeat that cycle ad nauseum. We have just a minute or two left. Yes, over here.
Did Bill ever acknowledge that there are other programs, OA,
he was asked by he was asked by Father Ed to start Fatties Anonymous, and he said, that's not my issue. And Father Ed Dowling said to Bill, you know, your cross to bear is alcohol, my cross to bear is butter, bread, you know, food. And he said, would you start Fatties Anonymous? And Bill said, no, I will not. It's not my issue. Not my issue. But we'll talk on Sunday when I get into step 12, what happened in 1960, on January the 19th, 1960. But Bill had no opinion on these other things. One more if it's a quickie. Going once. Going twice. Okay, we'll see you tomorrow.